You are listening to Clearly Connected, a podcast that inspires new ways to reconnect to ourselves, to others, and to our natural environment in a world where so many of us are disconnected. I'm your host, Carrie Doan. I'm a life coach, an entrepreneur, an advocate for change, and a believer in all things possible. I am so excited today to bring my dear friend and guest on, Human Policy Coordinator Rebecca Sides, to talk about something we all struggle with, and that is control. You'll get to hear her story of her battle with anorexia and how she overcame this protective coping strategy by letting go and learning to trust others and herself down the path of healing. I'm so glad you're here to join us as we all learn to let go and move closer to a more deeply connected way of living. Welcome back, all you beautiful people. Today, I am excited to have a conversation with someone who is very near and dear to me, Rebecca Sides. And she and I are going to talk about something that I think we all contend with on different levels. And that is the topic of control. Control is a mechanism we all use in order to feel safe and protected. And while it serves us to rein in our impulses, at a certain point, it can rob us of letting go and trusting life. Rebecca will share her story of what it was like to feel the grip of anorexia, how it controlled her, and how she eventually healed and reconnected to herself, surrendering into a new life of openness and trust. So let me give you a quick intro to my special guest before we dive in. Rebecca is a thoughtful systems-minded bridge builder who facilitates peer learning networks about federal human services policy. She has a master's degree in industrial organizational psychology from Xavier University, and in her spare time enjoys walking, running, hiking, and making craft chocolate. So, Rebecca, I'm so excited to finally have this conversation. Welcome.
Really glad to be here, Carrie. Yeah. It's a real honor.
Yeah. Well, let's go ahead. Let's start the conversation like I always do with my guests by asking if you could just tell us a little bit about your story and what was your life like growing up, and when did you start to feel that need to control your life?
Well, I'm glad that you're starting the story back when I grew up, because I was going to ask, how far back do you want to go? I wasn't anorexic until I was actually 25, and so the story goes back pretty far. You know, I am a white girl. I grew up in a lot of private systems. I actually grew up in a boarding school. My mom worked there as the director of development, and the school had high racial diversity, but it had low socioeconomic diversity and pretty high expectations. And with that came pressure to control, as a lot of our institutionalized systems do. Class started at 7:50, ended at 3:05. We had a work job from 3:05 to 3:15. We had to get changed for sports, and they started at 3:30. They went till 5:30. Then we had to shower, and dinner started at 6:15 and went till 7. And then we had study hours from 7 to 9. And if school starts at 7:50 in the morning, you got to get to bed. And so your day is just a rush every day. And in addition to that, I consider myself a person who has a high sensory attunement to my surroundings. I observe, I absorb information about what's happening around me. I can get overstimulated in a highly visual experience if, you know, there's a lot of light and a lot of sound. I reserve time to go be in crowded festivals maybe once or twice a year. I don't enjoy that all the time. And so I think the need for control is a little higher for me, especially now that our world is so integrated, our systems are so integrated. Even just going to the mall sometimes can feel a little overstimulating. When I went to go be a teacher in Korea, I think that was all exacerbated. I had the language ability of about a six-year-old by the time I left there. When I came, I was learning how to read. I couldn't say hello and goodbye when I got on the plane.
Wow.
In Korean.
Yeah.
And so then to kind of be in an environment where I couldn't communicate, I wanted to talk to a cashier and couldn't. And as you know, actually, folks listening probably don't, Korea is the size of about Indiana, but it's the population of Texas and New York combined. And 70% of the country is mountains. And so you have to take all those people and squeeze them into 30% of the size of Indiana. And so what that means is, where do you put all the people? On top of each other, right? So they live in big apartment buildings. And where do you put all the clothes and goods and stores? Underground. And there's a lot of shopping malls for miles just under the ground. And so there was just a lot to adjust to. And so I was quite overstimulated.
Mm-hmm. Wow. Wow. That is, I've never been to Korea and I had no idea, but the way you describe it, I can already in myself feel this like tight bit of overwhelm of just imagining the transition, the lack of the language skills that you needed to get by. So how did that experience, it sounds like it created that need to even like bear down more.
Mm-hmm.
How did that start to flesh itself out in your personal life? Like, what were the symptoms and the behaviors that you saw?
Well, from my upbringing, I'd learned to be a high achiever. I'd learned to kind of leverage this high sensitivity for performance and wanted to keep doing that as an English teacher. I had 600 students in third through sixth grade that I taught every week. I saw all 600 of them every week. And I taught 22 classes. Each of them had about 28 to 30 students. And you know, all of that actually didn't push me over the edge of overstimulation. It was actually the rules that foreign teachers were held to that were different from the rules of native teachers. And so native teachers were able to take off 2 weeks for breaks and had flexibility to leave work if they had a doctor's appointment. But foreign teachers were required to be at the school for certain hours of the day, even while everyone else was on vacation. And so there were 2 weeks every year where the foreign teachers were still at the school, and it was like us and the security guard.
Wow.
And in addition, there were no other foreign teachers assigned to the school, so we were alone. We were the only people from our country who spoke our language in the building 40 hours a week. Mm-hmm. And so it really depended on the language ability of the other native teachers, if they could speak English, about whether or not we would have relational connection mm-hmm. at work.
Wow. Yeah, that's a lot.
It was. Yeah. And I mean, I know anyone listening has a person in their network who's been a teacher in Korea. I know it's a really common experience, and a lot of people really thrive.
Mm-hmm.
I think because of my upbringing and kind of my own temperament, it was a perfect storm.
Mm-hmm. And was this around the time when you started to develop the behaviors and the symptoms of anorexia while you were over there?
Yeah, they... Dietitians will say that the mental habits will start about 6 months before the behavioral habits, and can be for much longer. And I'm sure, as anyone listening, women are held to all kinds of standards of their physique, of their beauty. And I wasn't shielded from those things, certainly, being in a wealthy school environment. But I had a lot of positive models. I think Korea really is the environment that sparked it. I mean, in general, my body and a typical Korean body are not the same. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I need to eat more mm-hmm. because I'm taller and, yeah, just I'm German. Yeah. And so, in the environment of, you know, we share everything, you know, there's one big dish in the center and we all just take a little bit. I just kind of got into habits where I wasn't really getting fully nourished. And based on the social environment around me, you know, maybe eating less is okay. Everyone else is eating less and doing okay. And so the habit and kind of seeing that way started earlier. And then it was actually during those 2 weeks of being alone in the school, knowing that any curriculum design I build will be restricted or changed because there were rigid curricular expectations, none of which were really working in teaching the students English, mm-hmm. but were the expectation of the program. Mm-hmm. So I was like, I can't use my agency to do anything. Mm-hmm. I can't create something that will be used in the classroom. What am I supposed to do with these 80 hours of sitting at this desk? And I thought, you know what? I'm just going to lose 5 pounds. Mm. And I researched on the first time in my life, I had researched from Google, how do you lose 5 pounds? Just yeah. type it in. And there's lots of articles that teach you how to lose 5 pounds. And so I put them into practice that evening and didn't have a scale. So I never really knew when I had lost 5 pounds. And mm. I didn't change those behaviors that I learned from that research that day for the next year and a half.
Wow.
In total, I ended up losing about 35 pounds.
Wow. Wow. And so it makes a lot of sense to me as you're talking, because what I heard you say is you lost some level of control and autonomy in the environment with which you were working. And so I think the natural response then is to say, what can I control? What can put me back in that safe place
and driver's seat?
Yes, in yep. the driver's seat. And so psychologically it makes a ton of sense why that would have been your response. So given that, like, what were the ways that you were seeing this set of behaviors impacting your life, like relationally, I don't know, spiritually, emotionally? Can you take us there?
Yeah, absolutely. Anorexia is really tricky. It's a slippery slope. At the beginning, you kind of feel like you're on a high. It the agency that you're refinding and the adrenaline that your body's experiencing as you're losing weight feels good. Mm. And you get a ton of compliments because in this historical era, being skinny is good. Mm-hmm. We'll see what happens in another 100 or 200 years. Mm-hmm. Actually, even now, that's already shifting in, yeah. in America. And but not in Korea, and certainly not at that time. So at the beginning, it felt great, and I loved the compliments, and it was fun to kind of try on different Korean clothes and not feel like I was too big for them, which is what I had felt the first 6 months. Over time, physically too, I mean, everything kind of started slowing down. So I stopped being able to manage time. You know, I'd like look up at the clock at work and it'd be 9 o'clock at night and everyone else had left and I was still at work planning for class. I stopped being able to learn Korean well and kind of put thoughts together. And relationally, I really stopped being able to form and maintain relationships. And again, it's really slow. It was hard for me to even notice it was happening. But, you know, now retrospectively, I can see, you know, I'd go home and I'd eat a little bit. And then I would wait an hour and a half and need just a little bit more. Mm-hmm. And wait another hour and need just a little bit more. And so it ended up being like 5 hours that I was kind of nibbling at food without realizing that that was the habit that I was in. And so it consumed my life. Mm-hmm. Making food, eating food, and restricting food became how I spent my time.
Wow.
And it replaced right? Controlling food replaced the space in my bandwidth for relationships mm-hmm. with myself and with others.
Mm.
And I think emotionally, kind of as my brain shut down, I wasn't really able to know how I felt. I stopped feeling.
Mm-hmm. Wow. It's so fascinating to think about that journey and how, you know, little by little, you even were unable to really see what was going on. It just became this slow, like, new norm of your mm-hmm. life. So given that, at what point did you kind of wake up and realize, like, there's an issue here, something needs to be different? Did you hit some kind of rock bottom, or was there a person that came into your life that pointed things out to you?
All of the above. Mm-hmm. And that is what's been so fun in rethinking through the story. You asked how it had impacted me spiritually, and a big part of this was also about trying to control some of the religious teaching I'd received, and fighting back against disciplines that I'd been taught. And yet there was this longing to be a part of a bigger picture, to be in a community with others where we were all participating in an idea together and really believed it and had stock in that thing. And so after about a year and a half, those longings were getting stronger. I had actually started going back to a church and had a mentor even that I was meeting with in the midst of all this. It's pretty amazing mm-hmm. that I somehow figured out how to manage it. And the time that I woke up had three stages. First, I spent a day, I was in a small group with this church, and I saw this woman break down and cry when people were asking for prayer requests. And I remember being so envious, like, why does she get support? Why does she get help? Well, anyway, she lived nearby a place where I was hiking that weekend, because when you're anorexic, you exercise all the time. I had run a 10K and tried to get 10,000 steps every day. And so I was going on a hike and asked her if she wanted to come. And so she, me, and another foreign teacher spent 7 hours together. And by spending 7 hours together, I quickly realized how much more energy they had than I did.
Wow.
Yeah.
It was noticeable.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. They could walk, you know, 2 miles without needing to eat. And I couldn't. And we took pictures, and they showed them to me. And I was like, whoa, I'm really small.
Mm-hmm.
We went to dinner, and we had a type of hot pot called shabu shabu, which is when you dip beef into broth that's boiling for the length of time it takes to say shabu shabu, and then you pull it out and you eat it with vegetables. Mm-hmm. But there's an array of food, and typically when you eat shabu shabu, you never finish all the food they give you. But I ate everything and was still starving.
Hmm.
And then we went to tea, and I was like, oh good, there'll be dessert there. And there wasn't, and I couldn't be present because all I was thinking about was that I needed food. And so I couldn't connect, and I couldn't listen, and my brain was always busy. That evening at 3:44 in the morning, I was still awake. I don't remember why, but I looked over at the clock and saw that it was 3:44. And it was the first time that I pulled out my computer, and I was like, I wonder if I have an eating disorder. And that's within the context of a lot of other symptoms I've had physically. Digestively, my system had basically shut down. So I was experiencing some extreme constipation. And I had noticed other people touch my back and be like, oh my gosh, are you okay? Because of how skinny my back was. And so, you know, there'd been like a year and a half of people kind of commenting about things. Like, the color in your face is gone. Are you okay?
Mm-hmm.
Every time I see you, you get skinnier. Are you okay? And so at that point, I typed it in, and I started reading about eating disorders. And I let that sit. I didn't talk to anyone. I just let it sit. I took some time to start reaching out to some dietitians just to explore. There were 18 pages of dietitians on a national eating disorder website, where I could meet with a virtual dietitian, even in Korea. So I started calling some just to kind of interview them. I had picked like three that I really liked. And I also, after about a few weeks, told my mentor. And she was like, well, you know, why don't you just try eating more? There were a few other people that were integrally involved. But I don't want to tell the whole, you know, I don't want to make this into an hour and a half story. Yeah. And so the third kind of key moment was when I took the GRE in Korea. And I had been studying for months, and this was all happening while I was studying. And I went to go take my test, and they, these days with electronic versions, can tell you the score immediately. And so my score was below what I had wanted it to be, what kind of my target was. And I remember the rule of having to sit in a room for 4 hours without having access to food was terrifying. And I had had a really big breakfast, and the whole test, I was so hungry and I couldn't think. And so it was actually that number that pushed me over the edge. And so I went back to the bathroom and cried. And from that facility, emailed a dietitian to ask for help.
Wow. Wow, so there was this series of events and people and situations that kind of like sparked your awareness to say, maybe something isn't okay here, or maybe they're right about this. And then comes this tipping point, and you finally like reach out to go find the support that you actually needed. One of the things that you said that kind of struck me was when you were in that setting and you saw this other woman getting support, and wondering like, well, how come she gets that? And I had this thought that I think that this is what control does sometimes, is it creates this feeling of isolation or separateness. Like, I have to do it all on my own, or I need to control this thing. And it, by its very nature, when done in the extreme, cuts us off from people. But deep down, it sounded like the very thing that you wanted was to be a part of something bigger, was to get support. And sometimes we don't even know how or what that next step is, but that is the longing of all people. And I think, yeah, control, it has that ability to just separate, right? So given that, like, well, first of all, thank you for sharing so vulnerably, because to me that sounds like it's a humbling path to get to those moments, right? Where there's a rock bottom, or the awareness like something's not right, I need to change. So I really appreciate your vulnerability. But given that we're kind of talking also on a parallel of connection, how did this experience relate to that idea of reconnection, right? So you went from this position of feeling maybe more isolated to asking for support, going towards someone else. And I'm just curious to know your thoughts about what did that do about your beliefs around connection?
What a great question. I think I'd actually like to go back to this woman who got help at small group. So her name was Bethany. And, you know, you're helping me realize she was actually the first person that I told. And it has been a in part reconnection spiritually first in learning to ask for help. So soon after I had looked up eating disorder on the internet, it was about a week where I decided to go ahead and pray. I need someone to tell. And the next day in church, I saw this woman, Bethany. And I don't know how it happened, but she was standing next to me on the sidewalk, like 2 hours after I had prayed this. after church. And somehow I was able to ask her. I don't remember the moments leading up to it, but I was holding her hands and said, "Bethany, how did you ask for help?" And she said, "That's the hardest part. Mm-hmm. Are you free on Tuesday?" And she took me to dinner, and she told me her whole story of learning to change big behavior. And for her, it was also through a spiritual kind of reconnection. And then she took me to dessert, and she said, "Now it's your turn." And so she was the first person that I told, and I actually wailed into her shoulder for 15 minutes in a public macaron shop in Korea. And it was kind of in trying to maintain our relationship that I really woke up to how sick I was, because she was so able to be consistent and present and available for me, but I couldn't reciprocate. And I would try to come on time to things, and I wouldn't. And, you know, she tried to meet me for dinner for my birthday, and I came like 2.5 hours late. And she stayed because she was dedicated to my recovery, and she knew I was sick. But she made a decision that night that she couldn't try to be friends with me because of how unable I was to connect. And so one of the mantras I had while I started to, what they call it, refeeding when you're healing from anorexia, because you have to eat about 3,500 calories a day to regain the weight because your metabolism is really sick. And I had a lot of mantras, and one of them was, "I eat for my brain, I eat for connection, I eat for community." Mm. Like, I need to eat for these things, and if I don't, I lose them. And so kind of in the midst of all this, there was one evening where I woke up and I said, "Rebecca, this is the life that you built for yourself. With the control that you had, you built this life. Are you happy with it?" And I said back to myself, "No." And I said, "Okay, what are you going to do about it?" And so it's fun, right? Because it's like a reharnessing of your control. Yes. Into connection, into this church community that I had, into these relationships I was building, and ultimately led me back to my family, to healing my relationships with my parents, to staying with my aunt and uncle, and allowing myself to just learn from them in connection. Mm-hmm. Just lived with them, cooked with them, gardened with them, and then has now blossomed into going to grad school, getting to serve the cohort that I was in and just have community with them. I found a new church here that I get to do that with as well. And stumbling into Weston Orwood, this adorable little walking community where I have connection on the sidewalk all the time that bubbles and builds into new places. Mm. And it's come through allowing and a posture of letting go.
Yes.
And just discovering what's here. So it's been iterative and a 5-year long walk in an intentional different direction.
I love how you just kind of took us through that progression, because I think this is true for, I would say, almost everybody. There is this journey, and I think it happens typically later in life, but learning how to actually let go and trust, and it takes a lot of healing work to get to that place. Mm-hmm. I think a lot of people wake up to certain facades and images that they've constructed, and then it's like there's this this disconnect internally that says, I'm not being who I am, or there's something not serving me in the ways that I've operated for years. And so then begins this journey of trying to figure out how to surrender, how to let go, how to kind of like trust the unknown. Mm-hmm. And it can feel terrifying. Like you said, that first step of getting support and confessing that there's something that you're struggling with, that I think is the hardest part. But then once you kind of live into it, there's such a liberation that comes.
Yeah.
And what I heard you say is the reconnection has been one of the greatest rewards of letting go of the control.
Yeah. Oh, so much fruit has come, right? Joy. There was this time where I started eating again and I was snuggling in my bed. You know, you do, you curl up in your bed with your pillow and it felt so good. And I was like, oh my God, I don't think I've had that sense in years. I don't think I've felt that dopamine feeling of like snuggling with a blanket because of how shut off my brain and body were. And so, I mean, thinking about the pleasure that my body was then able to start having through the healing of just even knowing what someone else needs and feeling relationally connected to them.
Mm-hmm.
Being able to assist with something, being a key player in a project, you know, just being alive.
Mm-hmm.
In so many ways, I was dying. And so, yeah, it's the ways that it's abounded through my community involvement, my long-term planning of how I want to show up in the world and contribute to something. And all of those things are so much more life-giving than a thigh gap.
Yeah. They really are. Oh gosh, yeah. And again, like, you're right. I think when we're at the edge of the cliff,
mm-hmm.
and we're asking ourselves, can I let go?
Mm-hmm.
It's just one of the biggest steps we could make. And we do this in macro and micro ways, I think, all throughout our days, mm-hmm. right? And it's a practice. But yeah, again, like there's so much to be gained, I think, by doing that and then regaining that trust in yourself, not needing to attach and cling and hold so tightly to this illusion that does nothing but separate you mm-hmm. from yourself, from others. There's a huge cost to that.
Yeah.
Right? So that's what I love so much about your story, is it illustrates like what's on the other side of it.
Mm-hmm. And I think something that came up just now listening to you is also intuition came back. It was as if while I wasn't eating, all I had to navigate my day was control.
Mm-hmm.
Control of minutes, control of calories, control of water, control of how many pieces of chocolate I've had, and counting. And yeah, it was terrifying to allow that to change. It was all I had known in Korea, is how I managed all the stimulation of mm-hmm. Korea.
Mm-hmm.
But to transition into, what if I just give my body the support that it needs and trust that it knows how to show up in the world? So I'm just going to eat what my body needs me to eat. And then I'm just going to listen to the cues of a space and trust that I'm welcome here and I have something to offer to this space. It changed the way that I know how to wake up each morning and the life I know how to build during the day.
Wow. Yeah, and what you said earlier is you became more alive,
mm-hmm.
right? Like you feel the pleasure in your body more. You probably had this emotional payoff of just feeling lighter, less constricted, maybe more expanded. And then, yeah, thinking even more broadly to your relationships, to your community, like the impact is so significant.
Mm-hmm.
So you mentioned before we started recording that you had some thoughts about, you know, order and structure, I think, and how that relates to connection. And I'd love to hear more about that.
Sure.
I want to get into it.
Well, for anyone who is listening and knows me, I'm a pattern finder. And so I like to track ideas that people are having that line up with each other, even if they're in different fields and different functions. And so something that I hit upon while in recovery was that Richard Rohr, he is a, I believe, Franciscan priest,
mm-hmm.
And has the Center for Contemplative Action out west. He has a book called Falling Upward, where he talks about order, moving to disorder, moving to reorder. And Stephen Covey has a book, The 7 Habits of Highly Effective People. And he talks about a transition from dependence to independence to interdependence, which, just as a quick plug, Carrie is a fantastic hairdresser, and it was talking about this transition that ignited our friendship the first time I was getting my hair cut. So my time of anorexia, my time of clinging to control, was my time of independence. I moved away from everyone I've ever known and said, I want to do it myself. I want to think about religion myself. I want to make sense of the world myself. I want to put everything I've ever experienced to the test, including health. And I don't want anyone's support. And I got really sick trying to be alone and trying to do it myself. And in this season of kind of having those supports, or realizing I can't support myself alone, and I need a system that will support me in my whole ecosystem, there was this pivot from independence to interdependence, or from disorder, which anorexia certainly created, ironically, to a reordering. And so at the beginning, there's this really strong against energy that you have to take on when you're recovering, because there's all these systems that are still here pushing you to be small, to not eat, to be voiceless, to whatever it is that the voices say, the negative voices say to each of us. But for me, they were very strong, to still be skinny and to hold on to control. So I had to push all of that away. There was this really strong energy toward choosing life, and it was still in a way independent. But once my body healed and stabilized, there's been this really cool moving back into structure. Honestly, going back to church was a huge part of that. Like, how do you receive a community of people saying that they're believing something but they can't live it, right? Mm-hmm. And moving into that space and being like, yeah, and that's okay. And I don't have to control every item on my to-do list. I'll just do the things that are most important, and that's okay. Mm-hmm. And I'll take this awesome job opportunity and move back to the neighborhood I want to move back to and live in the space, even though I can't furnish it perfectly today. And I'll hold the both and of some things look great and some things are still in boxes, and I'm going to do a little bit each day. And so I think coming back into structure, coming back into just an ordering of priorities. I'm going to make sure I sleep. I'm going to make sure I eat. I'm going to make sure I pray. And then I'll do what I can. Mm. And I'll know that things will fall into place. And so there's been a storm. Recovery is a storm. And then it settles. And then structure comes. And Richard Rohr is onto something.
Yeah. I love how you brought both of those concepts into this, because that progression, especially from the dependence, independence, the cost of that and the recognition that I cannot do this alone, leading you into figuring out how to rely on people in a healthy way, it's so evident in your story and how you've described this. I think I've been through that journey myself, and it's fascinating. I don't know if we can skip over any of those steps, but to stay open in the midst of it, to say, like, yes, this independence is serving me now, but also it's cutting me off from more. So how can I explore that? What does it mean to put those structures in place? How can I let go? How can I trust people now that I've created a trust in myself of what I'm capable of?
Yeah.
Right? So it's beautiful how to kind of like see human development in this way, even though there's so many painful lessons that we have to sometimes experience in order to get to the awareness that we need.
Yeah.
So I just, yeah, I love how you kind of illustrate it in that way. And I feel like we could unpack this topic for hours and days. I mean, you and I get into this all the time, and there's so many more layers we could unpack. But for the sake of time, I do want to ask you two final questions before we tie up. And I'm, let's say there's somebody listening right now who's in a place where they're like, I feel stuck, or I feel like I can't let go, like I'm just struggling. What would you say to that person to help them to kind of open to something else?
Well, first of all, you are not alone. I think every person goes through these seasons of feeling stuck, of feeling restless, of feeling like there's something missing. We name it differently, we experience it differently, but I think it's part of the human experience. And I think the right next thing here is activate yourself toward your longing. I had a few different mantras that came out of the beginnings of my time in recovery, and one of them was, take stock of your lemons. In order to make lemonade, you have to take stock of your lemons. And another was, what power do I have and what can I do with it? All three of those things are hopefully images that can help guide what it is that is your next step. I think the key theme I want everyone to take away from this is that it was a process, that it was iterative, that it was in baby steps, and that there were times where I would look at my body and I would look at someone's healthy body and I would say, Rebecca, you are 3 years away from there. And that is hard. But today, the only thing you can do today, what power do I have? What can I do with it? Today you can eat. That's what you can do.
Yes.
And the rest will come. My dietitian told me a story of one of her old clients getting pregnant, and I was like, ugh, I don't have a period and I don't know when I will. And that feels so far away. And all I can do today, if that's my longing, to activate myself toward it, is to eat.
Wow, just dial it back to the simplest thing today. That's really and truly all we can do anyways, right? You know?
That's exactly
just
right.
Simplify it. It's so true. I love what you said too about activating yourself toward your longing. Yes. Yes. And that comes with that rekindling of the intuitive sense. That's where it resides, and to pay attention to that part of yourself.
And maybe that's a part of the reorder, is to clarify what is yours to control. Mm-hmm. Because we all have a part to play in our own lives, in our community's lives, in our nation's story. We all have a seat. Mm-hmm. But a lot of us feel frustrated by rigid systems, and so we try to control things that are not ours to control. And then the things that are, in fact, ours to control, we don't show up to.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think in this reordering, for me, there's been this clarity of, okay, I need to have a profession. Great. I want to go be a part of federal policy. Okay. I need to have a place to live. I want to live in an apartment building where I get to know other people and neighborhood kids, and live in a neighborhood where I can walk around. And, you know, in this government system, we are highly encouraged to live in homes with a two-parent household. And there's a lot of messaging that one person should be a man and one person should be a woman. And that's the pressure we feel from our policy. And that pressure we feel from the policy, I can't control that. I could influence it. I can be strategic with how I build my social connections of those who are not following that system and see them as enlightened guides against these systems of control. And I can start building bridges in my city. But getting clear on, like, taking care of my body, that's mine.
Mm-hmm.
And building a community of people who also value the dignity of my body, that's mine.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm going to build that.
Yes. And that reminds me of this quote that I think of often. And it's something like, the way that we change the world is by changing ourselves. And it's so simple, and yet we often forget or ignore that. And
Gandhi, I think, said that.
Yes. Yeah. And it maybe is as simple as feeding your body. So, and that's all very doable if we're awake to it. Oh, wow. Well, thank you so much for sharing this. And before we tie this up, I want to ask you a question I ask all my guests, which is, what are you up to right now that has you excited?
Ooh, I love that. So, kind of given what we've talked about in terms of reordering and structure, honestly, what's exciting me a lot right now is nesting. I moved into a new space that has like 12-foot high ceilings and is bigger than any of the apartments I've lived in before. And I'm really enjoying, slowly but surely, one purchase by one purchase over a period of time that is long, nesting it and furnishing it and figuring out different color schemes and where the light works with the room and filling it with plants.
I love that. Creating your own little ecosystem and structure of a safe haven.
Because that is mine to control.
Yeah. That's right.
Oh. And a space to connect in.
Yes.
Really, to get it ready to host others.
Wow, that's beautiful. So beautiful. Well, at some point, I think we should get into the systems piece and do another one, because that's a whole other topic on control and how to navigate these worlds that you are so steeped in now in your work, and how we can kind of supersede that. So I'm going to earmark that for future one.
Definitely interested in a round two, Carrie.
Yes, to be continued. But it has been such an honor to have you, you know, sharing your story, hearing your insights and your wisdom from your lived experience. And it teaches us how we can better let go of control in our own lives, I think. And it's so encouraging to, you know, have this open dialogue about how to have this deeper connection, not just with ourselves, but with our communities. And I think it starts with that first step of letting go and surrender and activating your longing. That one's going to get an emphasis today. So I really appreciate you taking the time to have this vulnerable conversation.
Thank you for creating space to always connect, Carrie.
You're welcome. My pleasure. Well, everyone, thank you for taking the time to tune in today. And I encourage you in this moment to just consider one small way that you can open your hands, examine your fears, and let go of control as you lean further into connection.
If this episode resonated with you, I have something you are going to love. As you may know, part of what helps me live an authentic life is embracing one that is full of connection and adventure. Building a coaching business centered on connection has sparked many of my clients to their own success while offering me the passion of getting to do what I love every day. If you're curious about what it means to live a more authentic life, I have a free resource for 5 steps to live more authentically to give you simple steps to start walking you toward your true soul-aligned self. I'll link it in the show notes, so definitely check it out if you're interested. I'm so glad you joined us, and remember to stay connected.